Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
Good morning, sir.
Very good. North Koreans have celebrated the 4th of July by telling us that they have an ICBM, which is questionable. How good is it? Is it really something that we should be super concerned about or a little bit concerned about? The other thing so far, I haven't heard or seen, nobody's claiming that they have about six nukes made or one nuke made. You know, we don't even talk about that. But nevertheless, it's an urgent thing, and they have to do something about it. We have to have a position. And, of course, does our position coincide with the South Koreans? Maybe the South Koreans have a position. They have most at stake there. You know, Seoul is, what, 35, 40 miles from the border, so they're very, very vulnerable. And yet right now we're seeing signs that they're not exactly with what we want to do. You know, I saw one discussion. Well, our options are we can do decapitation, just take out Un. We can bomb all the sites, you know, and that'll settle anything. Or we can really put sanctions on there because they depend on us so much. You know, they need IMF and all this. Put sanctions on them. So those are the things being discussed. But I think one thing that I wanted to do this program on is to suggest to our government and to people who are listening, to anybody interested, is maybe we should at least have some respect and concern for what's going on in the minds of the people who run South Korea.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. You know, and I think this new level of tension, just when you think it can't ratchet up, it does. A lot of it comes about because of Trump's tweetaholism. You know, he's tweeting constantly. He tweeted, you know, not too long ago that, you know, we will not allow North Korea to get an ICBM capability. And perhaps they did, as you point out, we're not sure. Possibly it could have reached Alaska. And so by tweeting this way, he backs himself into a corner to where his only response, you know, he's going to be put into a corner where he has to have some sort of a military response, which would be catastrophic. Whereas if his first impulse had been more diplomacy rather than bluster, you know, we probably wouldn't be at this level of tension.
You know, in a way, it reminds me of the red line of Obama. The red line is gas, and then there's gas, and then they do something, and then they discover, well, maybe he didn't really, you know, do the gas. So here he draws a red line, ICBM. But is the ICBM, you know, exactly what people visualize? Something that is very accurate and really is going to, you know, bring devastation to the neighborhood or to us? And all of a sudden, you know, the answers are, well, no. Maybe there's a method to his madness. And I think there is a method to his madness because I think he understands us, our administrations, our tough guy policy, and yet most of the time our tough policy backfires on us, whether it was the Korean War, the Vietnam War, what we did in the Middle East. But one thing that they might be looking at is the fact that if a dictator, you know, is on the verge of having a nuclear weapon, and then they say, well, we're not going to do it if you're nice to us, mm-hmm. and they come around, and Gaddafi and you know, the Saddam Hussein, these countries came along and then they were taken out. So I would think that maybe he's not as illogical as some people think he is.
Well, it's an interesting comparison you make with the red line in Syria, because the same question could be asked for both scenarios, which is why? First, in the case of Syria, why would Assad gas a couple of people when he's got a big war to fight? Doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't Kim Jong-un develop nuclear weapons? Because everyone he's seen that's given them up has gotten overthrown. It's a matter of survival. So we're giving them perverse incentives to do things that we say that we don't want them to do.
You know, coming up with an easy answer under this situation is not easy because there's a lot of ramification. In medicine, it was much easier to think of the cause, you know, what caused this problem, you know, and deal with it and maybe prevent something later on or deal with it once you know the cause. But we don't have that choice. We have to deal with this and the South Koreans do. But if you're looking for, you know, overall long-term policy, you'd have to say, Mr. Truman, what did you have in mind?
Yeah.
You know, here we are just a couple years out of World War II. We set up this United Nations, and all of a sudden, without a congressional vote, we go into this war where 35,000 American troops are killed. And then we end up in a stalemate. And we end up with a problem there that existed. Billions and billions of dollars we have spent. And every time South Korea has wanted to have a slight bit of communication with North, because it would be natural for families wanting to get together again, we were impeding it. It wasn't the presidents of South Korea, and I understand that sentiment is still pretty strong. The more this talk goes on, it doesn't look like the South Koreans are saying, yeah, boy, we need more troops, we need more money, we need more American troops, and get ready for this war. That's not really going on.
Yeah, and I think there was a very significant election in May where the new president, Moon Jae-in, was really elected because he promised to renew the Sunshine Policy of opening dialogue again with North Korea. He got in office. He suspended the deployment of the U.S. THAAD missiles, which is a big sign. He's calling for diplomacy, economic, cultural engagement with North Korea. And here's something I know that is near and dear to your heart. He recently welcomed the delegation of North Korean athletes to South Korea to participate in the World Taekwondo Championships, and he proposed a joint Korean team for the 2018 Winter Olympics. So sports diplomacy.
And I'll bet you if you took a poll, if you're allowed to do that, had all the people actually reflect on that, North and South, I'll bet they'd all say, you know, that sounds like a pretty good idea. And then they would be more unified in a positive way in saying, look, we're going to show what Koreans can do and compete. And they probably could have some pretty good teams, you know. At least it would be so different than saber rattling and I'm going to bomb you, I'm going to kill you, and more sanctions, and it just goes on and on. So it'll be interesting to see how this evolved, but I guess there's a meeting this week, the G20, and there'll be some discussions along this line, even though there'll be other discussions going on this weekend too. But this will be high on the agenda.
I was just going to mention, in fact, they did take a poll recently.
Okay.
80% of Koreans support renewed dialogue with North Korea. So that's a big margin.
That would be the South Koreans.
Yeah, South Koreans. Yeah. So if they feel they if Moon feels like he has a mandate, there you have it. But you mentioned meetings, and there are. This is a really packed week of meetings, very interesting meetings. President Putin of Russia and President Xi of China will meet tomorrow in Moscow. And you can be sure that the North Korea issue is going to be high on the agenda. What's interesting is just over the past couple of days, Russia has joined with China in proposing a way to ratchet the tensions down. And they both agree on saying, okay, North Korea, first of all, they condemned the test yesterday. And they said, look, no more nuclear testing, no more firing these ballistic missiles, back off. U.S., here's your end of the bargain, U.S. and South Korea, stop holding these large-scale military exercises on North Korea's border. If you can both do that, then maybe we can tone down the tensions. That sounds pretty reasonable.
What is the prediction or the conventional wisdom of what a dedicated neocon would say about this? How do they come back and criticize this? Because they wouldn't want this. I mean, they might pay lip service or something like that, but they really don't want this because that would destroy their plan to have the friction, you know, the conflict continue.
They do need the tensions, and actually, it's interesting you mentioned that because I prepared a little graphic to put up if we can have it. This might surprise you, but this is Max Boot, our arch neocon enemy.
Uh-huh.
He hates the idea of this bargain that the Russians and Chinese are proposing. But I read this and I thought he was cribbing some of your notes because, you know, to summarize, he's essentially saying we faced this nuclear threat before from the Soviet Union and China. Mao and Stalin were far crazier than Kim Jong-un is. Why don't we just stay patient, don't do anything that could start a major war, and just let North Korea collapse under its own weight if that's what's going to happen. And I thought, wow, that's interesting.
Well, at least it's out there. So my guess is that behind the scenes, there's a bunch of Bill Crystals out there that said, boy, we can't have that. It might work. So that would be a dangerous thing from their point of view. But, you know, people who use force and rely on force and threat and intimidation, I may be wrong on this, but what it suggests to me, sort of, you know, the bully in your school class, and sometimes a bully is really not that tough. You stand up to a bully, sometimes they melt away. And there's insecure people, and they're trying to convince themselves they're tough. And I think in many ways we do this. We use force to show how strong and tough and good, even good. We throw in good, American exceptionalism. But I think there's, you know, a loss of confidence in what we really believe in. You know, if we had a great deal of confidence in what American values should be, and confidence in the marketplace, and that people are more likely to get along if you don't precipitate and antagonize. Because look at the evidence of sanctions. Where have they showed, that sanctions solves a lot of problems? But the sanctions didn't do much for Cuba. We were going to getting rid of them, and now we're, you know, going back to them again. And this is this. And they throw this up. There are some people who are still seriously talking about really tough sanctions. How much tougher can you sanction a country like this?
Yeah.
You know. So I think it's great that you see signs of the people in South Korea who are in the most danger are willing to think along these lines. I think this is good, but if we, antagonize and not support them and say no, you have to use force, then you throw this in. There's an ongoing deal with Trump and the Chinese. You know, yes, they're the worst people in the world, then the next time he's a great guy, and today it was trade with North Korea and China went up 40%.
So
we have to stop this thing. So it goes on and on. And yet I think really it's trade. What you need, it's good. The North Koreans, they probably don't love Chinese, but you know, they're mutually beneficial now because they go back and forth and trade together, and that's why China doesn't want to cut that off, you know. So it's a real pity that people in their insecurity and misunderstanding of how you bring about peace, I think the authoritarians who promote what we don't like, I imagine, just from the experience in Washington, that deep down in their heart, I'm going to give them the benefit of that. They say, you know, you have to be tough. It's a peace through strength and with the intimidation and be right there and attack, and sort of like, you know, what Trump has done so far. The biggest bomb ever was dropped on Afghanistan. For what purpose, other than to say this is what could happen to you guys? You know, I just think that lacks any confidence in our military. Why do we have to do this to show them? Everybody knows how tough we are.
Yeah.
You know, in Russia, we have to be terrified of Russia. What we made the point the other day, that Russia spends $1 for every 10 that we spend. We spend 10 times as much, and we're every place. We've surrounded Iran, we've surrounded Russia, and we're in 130 countries. We don't even know how many countries the special forces are in, but they're tough guys, you know. So, and it's always they're coming to get us, and have absolutely no confidence on how a free society might thrive. Then I get to thinking, well, you know, Switzerland sort of survived it all.
Amazing.
You know, in the middle of two wars, the 20th century, but nobody thinks about, could that work on a larger scale? I happen to think it can, because I think, even though I don't think that situation was perfect, it was a good example on how you can survive in the midst of terrorism and terror and bombing and world wars.
You know, I just remembered a sanctions story, and I don't know if you remember this, but back when you were in the House in the International Relations Committee, whenever a new, I remember this specifically, a new sanctions thing would come up, and you said that same thing. Sanctions don't work. They never work. There's no episode in history where they've worked. And the late Tom Lantos would correct you. The gentleman from Texas, let me tell you, Libya is the great example of how sanctions work. Look, they've given up their nuclear weapons because of all of our sanctions. And look, and Lantos has passed, but look what happened to Libya ultimately.
Which has an effect on what's going on in Korea right now. But you know, this subject came up frequently on foreign policy, and my position was different than some other Republican. Mm-hmm. But I've made this point, but I think it's an important point, and I get to make it once again. And that is, in my lifetime, you know, I remember World War II, and it was over, and that was great. Amazing military operations occurred in two and a half, three years, you know, compared to what's going on now, 16, 17 years in Afghanistan. So what my point was that I can remember my family being disturbed. Another war, when Korea War, that was barely 5 years. And here they were going into war, and there was not a lot of yelling and screaming about, well, is there going to be a declaration of war? No, nothing like that. But there were essentially 35,000 Americans lost their lives, and then that went into a stalemate, and we divided it up, permanent division. Then in Vietnam comes up. Here goes another war. And I had worried or been concerned that there would be one day I'd be drafted, and sure enough, I was drafted at an older age than average because I was a doctor, and they could do that. So we lost 60,000 Americans, but we had to sort of turn tail and run, which was humiliating, which was horrible. And yet it ended. You know, we just got out of there. Tragic ending. All that lives lost and everything. But the thing of it is, we walked away in the so-called victory for North Vietnam. The communists won. The communists won. Now there's going to be a domino effect. They're going to take over the whole world. Well, they had a non-viable policy. It didn't work. And it became more westernized. Mm. And I keep saying, we won more in peace than in war, and all the war was wasted. And look, we perpetuated this. If the United States had not been in there, if they had not been involved with the Truman Doctrine of marching in there and us fighting and then going, you know, dividing up the country, we wouldn't be talking about this. It'd be over with. The Koreans would have settled this a long time. This is all we're asking right now. Let the Koreans be Koreans. Let the South Koreans, let them determine their policy, and we'd be a lot better off.
Remember, Nicholas Taleb told us that about the Palestinians and Israelis. You know, if people would have stayed out of it, they would have found a way to solve it. But you know, I just had kind of a final thought.
Okay.
If you're ready for that, and that's, you know, and you alluded to this. You know, Trump tweeted that he's trade is up 40% between China and North Korea. So much for trying to get working with China. You know, and this is just a week after he's praising China. I mean, that kind of incredible turnaround must give whiplash to anyone trying to do diplomacy or anything. And I was just wondering, maybe this is why he's having so much trouble filling these sort of mid-high-level positions at state in the Pentagon. I talked to a friend of mine at the Pentagon and said the halls are empty, you know, all these appointees. I wonder if people just don't want to go work for someone like this who just turns on a dime.
Well, I feel like the whiplash is a pretty good term, because it may be that we philosophically get whiplashed. We think, oh, we know, we've heard what Trump had to say in the campaign and his position on Russia, and then, it ends. And now, on this trip, I understand that Trump will be stopping in Ukraine, and my prediction is that he's going to be very friendly and complimentary of NATO and their new government and how great they are, the greatest country in Eastern Europe. And at the same time, what will he, if he does that, are we going to have better ties with Russia? Why can't he just be talking to both? But he has to defend the coup. The coup was United States and NATO throwing out an elected leader that liked that was more sympathetic to Russia. So that's, you know, likely to happen and continue this process. But the other thing, if you look at it from a Chinese viewpoint, what's going on, you know, we just approved a $1.3 billion worth of sale of weapons to Taiwan. Well, who does that, how does that help promote peace? How does it help promote our defense? All it promotes are the pocketbook of the military-industrial complex. That's who benefits from this. And this is the reason why it should be so attractive to the American people and to people of the world to have policies of minding our own business, let people be their own selves, and let them, if there are problems on border disputes, then let them take care of it. But when outsiders come in, and just think of the Middle East, how long has it been since the Westerners, Europeans and Americans, have been involved in the Middle East? For a long, long time. And it's time we change our position, because right now it looks like there's still a lot of weapons out there, and they're always looking for another excuse to build more weapons. So I'd like to give them an excuse for building a lot less. Take all that money that's going into war and killing and the militarization of the world and spend it on something much better, maybe peace and prosperity. That should be our goal. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.